Hello, you're listening to Reacquainted, the show where Joe Martin and Adam Bulley get reacquainted after way too long of time. And now we're quizzing each other and debating our political positions. Last time it was healthcare, and now, when last we left our hero, I'm the hero, we were about to discuss minimum wage.
I will lead off on the next topic. I will grab minimum wage and say that a minimum wage, I think, is something we should abolish and do without. It is a noble-sounding program with several notable flaws. It's a noble-sounding program because it attempts to raise the living standards and the ease of life of all Americans by setting a floor for income. Its notable flaws is that this is a social problem that we've, for some confounding reason, decided to push off on individual businesses who may not actually be set up to provide that kind of a social service, namely paying a high wage. Wages are like anything else in economics when you're talking about buying and selling. The wage is the price for labor that is being bought and that is being sold. When you raise the price of anything, people tend to buy less of it. And this is just as true in the market for labor as it is in the market for pencils or Lamborghinis. If we want to make sure all Americans are working, we should make sure that all Americans can work at the price their employer can afford to pay. And if we think that price is not high enough to provide a standard of living that is what we want, we should provide for that outside of the employment market rather than trying to shoehorn it into the employment market.
The minimum wage. It's the first common, I'd say, mischaracterization is that we are in fact paying for a certain amount of labor, and therefore, you know, your labor is only worth so much. What you are paying for is a person, and if that person is incapable of surviving, then much like an animal, much like an animal, that person cannot survive on the amount of money that you are paying, then you have run afoul of basic human dignity. I'm open to considering other alternatives to the employment market, but Joe doesn't believe in income redistribution, which means that he is suggesting private charity and so forth. And the problem with that, of course, is that we know that private charity does not pick up the slack. If it did, it would have. Yes, minimum wage might slow economic growth. To people who worship money, this is a problem. But the health of our nation and the good of our country should not be measured by the stock exchange. And I guess, again, that's all I have to really say about that.
And so now you've heard our 90-second each capsule summaries of where we stand on the minimum wage. Adam, would you like to go into a little bit more detail about why you think it is that we should be providing not a minimum wage, but a livable wage? And maybe why you think we should be providing that through employers rather than through another means?
Well, if by other means you're discussing universal basic income, Joe, then I am willing to discuss that. But I suspect, knowing that you still subscribe to mainly libertarian ideals, that you are not. I think that in any just society that is capable of sustaining such a program, and the United States, as the richest country to ever exist, arguably does, that the minimum wage and the living wage should be one and the same. When you are, again, to restate one very important point from the prelude, you are not paying for, yes, you are paying for someone's labor, but that is another way of saying you are paying for their time, and humans have a finite amount of it. If you are not paying someone enough to live, then that is a problem. And yes, we can all think of situations in which people might be willing to pay, to earn less than their time is calculated through imperfect human means to be worth. You know, the senior citizen who has enough money, although they're few enough these days, to retire but just enjoys working, or the teenager who's saving up for their new car. But the fact of the matter is that the average worker at McDonald's is now 29 years old. That Walmart greeter is probably trying to pay for his or her medicine. And Walmart sustains the money that it pays its customers, or its employees, in no small part because of federal programs that are currently ongoing. You know, we are not, the minimum wage is not supporting these people as things stand. It is only through government intervention that they are still eating. I think that should change. The concerns about unemployment are valid. Really, almost every argument is valid in the sense that it pitches one value against another. But the overriding value has to be human life, and much and almost like healthcare, the ability to survive on your wages is baseline. What do you reckon, Joe?
I think I'll surprise you. I am in favor of a universal basic income. If we want to talk about replacing the welfare state as it exists now with a universal basic income, I am more than willing to come to that negotiating table. We have a massive welfare state in the U.S. I don't think it's particularly effective. I think it's has a lot of duplicative programs. I think it has a lot of useless programs. I think we do a lot of spending to no good effect. And if we're going to talk about, let's jettison all of that, let's jettison the career jobs for the bureaucrats that are all over state and federal governments administering programs that may or may not be doing any good, if we're going to come to the table and talk about, let's jettison that and take all the money we're spending on that and giving it to people as a universal basic income, I am ready to come to that table and have that discussion. I am eager to have that discussion. I would love to see it happen. I think when push comes to shove, the government unions that run all of these programs and run all of these bureaucracies are going to come run screaming away from the table and argue that we should not have a universal basic income, that instead it is absolutely necessary that we have whatever it is program that they administer, that that program is vital to the success and the endurance of this nation as we know it. So I think it's going to be a tougher sell on your side of the aisle than it is going to be on my side of the aisle. But by all means, let's have a universal basic income.
By your side of the aisle, by the way, what exactly do you mean?
Why the side of the aisle that I sit on all by myself.
that fourth quadrant of the aisle in the White House, or not the White House, sorry, but Congress.
Exactly. The one that's over in the corner that has this broad 50-foot swath where that's radioactive that no one else dares cross.
No, wait, I've got it. It's the balcony section where the tourists also are.
That's about the only section of Congress I'm likely to get into at any point in my life. No, I would say the libertarian side of the aisle. This is something that has been a topic of discussion at the Cato Institute and elsewhere for the past couple of years, and I don't think there's universal agreement over here among the libertarian think tanks that this is the way to go, but I think there's universal agreement that this is something that is very much worth discussing as an alternative to the welfare state as we know it.
That's
how many Republicans are likely to buy into this, I honestly don't know. I thought I understood the Republican Party, and then they went and nominated Trump, so clearly I have no idea what goes on in the minds of Republican voters.
Well, the Republican Party has almost no values at this point. So I don't think it's really worth even discussing their reaction.
No, but they are political actors and have incentives that they respond to.
Fair enough.
Even all the way Touché. Down to the voters. I'm just not clear I understand at the moment what those incentives are.
Hatred of Obama would be one.
Well, obviously, but you could say that about the Democrats. One of their motivating principles right now is hatred of Trump, which, fair enough, but that would, I think you would agree, be a rather uncharitable view that while it's certainly there, doesn't explain everything. And I would argue the same is true on the Republican side.
I mean, that sounds like a great topic to discuss when we engage in our discussion of political politically violent rhetoric.
Political extremism, an episode coming to you in 3 months' time.
Episode 27.
Stay on the edge of your seats. It's on the way. Just well, like Ms. Marvel.
I admit to being somewhat floored. It's interesting to me that this discussion is being had in libertarian circles, and I guess it's a sign of how disconnected I am from that community. You know, when I think of libertarianism, usually I'm either thinking about the Libertarian Party these days, or maybe those wonderfully nutty people living in New Hampshire who roar about porcupine power, who are still fun to listen to. So you're interested in the idea. What do you think about? I mean, but you're not supporting it on the grounds that people should be allowed to live. Just on, I mean, would that be correct?
I don't think that's accurate. I think you keep wanting to put it to, or I'm willing to see people die if that means a smaller government, and I'm not. I'm very much a pragmatic libertarian. I think we can keep people alive with a government that's, I don't know, half the size of the government we have. My problem isn't that we're working on keeping people alive. My problem is we've got an awful lot of waste and of empire building in the government, that it's not, yes, every program starts with the goal of doing something to keep people alive, but it grows, it metastasizes, it evolves, it changes, it becomes something that is unmoored from its roots, and we could get better results at a lower cost. And that's where I'm coming from. If we're going to have a minimum floor that supports people, fine, let's have a minimum floor that supports people, but let's do it in the most efficient way possible. Not that we're cutting people off and watching them die in the streets, not efficiency, money is my God, preserve corporate profits at all intents. I am pro-market, anti-business. I do not believe in the survival of any given business. Businesses are free to profit, and they're free to experience massive losses and die and go away. And I would like the same to be true of federal government programs, that if they're delivering a benefit, well and good. If they're not, burn them to the ground. I want to see people prosper. I don't want to see specific bureaucrats, departments, and programs prospering.
And this is something that I am sympathetic to. I think that there's a conceivable, and I'm for private companies, and I still enjoy them. I mean, I would have to be, really. I write corporate histories. If I hated companies and the ideas of profit, I really couldn't do my job. Actually, I find having read Ayn Rand almost, you know, a particularly helpful thing there, because what she did was make business into a heroic epic. But, you know, they're putting aside private contributions to our problems. There is an antidote to this issue, which, you know, then there are, and government is not alone in having issues, and that's civic engagement. John Ossoff, who was, I'm not saying, you know, was the man that people spurned, but Jesus' second coming or anything, but he had a background in exposing, at least he claimed to, maybe this isn't even true, I don't know, but he a background in exposing government waste. I mean, he was a documentarian. These people exist on the left. You know, people who not only want to have government programs, but want to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to do, and at a reasonable cost. You know, we can have that. And I think that your philosophy itself, I mean, libertarianism and the strain of it, I realize that Republicans are not libertarians, but the strain of it, or of rhetoric that runs through the party, in many ways drains at that civic engagement with its continuous attacks on the very idea of government institutions. You know, how involved are you in your in public education if you can just move your children to this little private school that'll teach them you know, the way you want them to think? Then who's watching out for those other kids?
No, it's impossible to get through education without being civically minded these days. The amount of donating, volunteering, assisting, showing up, and being present that you're expected to do as a parent of school-aged children is remarkably high. No less so in private school than it is in public. In both situations, parents are expected to be present and engaged, are continually invited, begged, harassed, and cajoled into being present. Again, private and public, both. So I would say the fact that I would want to get rid of particular programs in no way says I want to be civically disengaged. Churches are huge civic engagement factories. You know, maybe you can quibble with how much a given evangelical church is doing, but I can say watching all of the churches around here in Madison, Oregon, all of the surrounding Verona, Mount Horeb, Sun Prairie, surrounding communities, they are all almost competing with each other to see who can be most engaged in helping out in food pantries, who can be most engaged in helping out in crisis pregnancy centers, most engaged in handing out backpacks loaded with school supplies to kids in the local schools who are poor, most engaged with who can be giving coats to the homeless. So there is a vast amount of civic engagement that happens outside of government. And I would say that is one, I think government retards civic engagement, not promotes it. I'm very, very much in favor of civic engagement.
I think if the government retarded, well, I don't know. I mean, it depends on how you define civic engagement, I guess. But
I was going to say, if you're going to define it as there's a place where you can go and somebody, you fill out a form and somebody gives you a check or goods or something, then yes, I can't argue that government doesn't civically engage in that way. But I mean in terms of just people reaching out to people rather than people giving resources to someone else who then reaches out to people.
Once again, I feel like we've come to this crux of the matter, which is your argument that a private network or a private economy would do better at these things, which I think to no small degree remains unproven. But, you know, especially when you compare the records of countries. But regardless, that I don't think you're making the claim that these organizations are completing the job. And I would challenge you on this point that if they're not doing the job, then the government's coercion, naked coercion if you prefer, you know, should finish it.
Well, and I think maybe we're getting sidetracked into a misunderstanding, because this started with me saying that I want a smaller, more efficient government that helps people more effectively at a lower price than what we currently have.
Mm.
And you turned that into, if we shrink government, the problem with libertarians is we're shrinking civic engagement.
You're right. Okay. I can see how that twists the scope of the conversation.
Right. Because I'm still saying, as a pragmatic libertarian, you know, maybe 100, 150 years from now, do I think we could end up in a situation where private charity meets a heck of a lot of needs? Sure. But that's theoretical. That's 100, 150 years from now. Over the next, you know, policy horizon of 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, I would like to reform things such that we have a much smaller government that does a much better job of helping people out than what we currently have. And in that model, I think we've got a lot of civic engagement, and I think we would continue to have a lot of civic engagement. The question is, and I'll go ahead and very explicitly stick a finger in someone's eye and say, I think the problem, a portion of the problem, not the entire problem, but a portion of the problem why we can't shrink government and have it work more efficiently is government unions, public sector unions of government employees, employees who are quite rationally, quite understandably, interested in protecting their jobs. They see themselves as helping people. They see their departments as having good work to do, and they see any attempt to cut their departmental budget, to shrink their departmental workforce, as being a threat. Really, it's a threat to their livelihood, but they see it as being a threat to the people that they're trying to serve. And so any attempt you make to cut the budget for any program gets met with all kinds of commentary and reasons why that program, why those employees are absolutely vital to keeping things running. And I think the focus should not be on specific programs, but it should be on specific needs and whether we are meeting those specific needs. And if you can do that with a universal basic income guarantee, BIG, the other acronym it goes under, without a lot of government employees, well and good. And I'm going to tie this back to where we started with minimum wage.
That'll be impressive. Go for it.
You said, and I'm going to make a broader point, but hopefully you'll see it all tie together. Mm-hmm. You said the reason we should have a decent minimum wage is we are not buying people's labor, but we are buying their time. In a sense, they are not just economic actors. They are human beings, and they are worthy of a certain dignity. I'm expanding a bit. This is not direct quoting, but I'm hoping you'll agree that I'm representing you accurately. These are people who are worthy of a certain level of respect and a certain level of dignity as human beings. And the question shouldn't be whether we can get away with paying them $3 an hour, because that devalues who they are. We should be treating them as human beings, as valued members of our community, and we should be paying them in accordance with that dignity and with that value. And I'll pause and say, does that accurately reflect your feelings? Because I'm not trying to be sarcastic, or I'm trying to fairly restate it.
Yes, and what is more, we are capable of doing that. Perhaps 100 years ago, this was not the case. I won't argue the point that this is an eternal principle or what have you, but it is very doable. Please continue.
Okay, so I would argue counter. The purpose of an economy is not to produce. The purpose of an economy is to consume. I am not made better off if I am working. You are not made better off if you are working. We're both made better off if we're consuming. If you're able to drink the rum that you enjoy while we're having a conversation, if we're able to have a conversation here over the internet in separate states, which is miraculous in a certain sense, we're able to record that and play it back for others. We're allowed to drive around in cars that are safe and convenient. And let's go with the dream, zero polluting emissions. They're zero emissions vehicles that are safe, convenient, friendly, dare I say, fun. We're able to live in homes that are well protected from the elements, from both extreme heat and extreme cold. We're able to eat a wide variety of foods in and out of season. You want a strawberry in December, have a strawberry in December, a fresh, juicy, bursting with flavor strawberry in December. That is the purpose of an economy, to keep you healthy, to keep you well fed, to keep you entertained, to keep you motivated, to keep you enjoying life, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The point of an economy is to consume all of that. The work that we do is just the necessary cost that we haven't figured out how to get rid of yet. But we're doing better and better and better than we ever have before at any other point in human history. The amount of labor that it takes to produce goods for consumption is lower than it ever has before. I mean, in the early 1900s, late 1800s, something like 90% of the U.S. population was engaged in farming. It took virtually the entire population of the United States to produce the food necessary to feed the entire population of the United States. Now we're here at a time period where only 4% of the population is engaged in farming. 4% of the population is able to produce enough food to feed the entire rest of the nation three times over, judging by the obesity crisis. I would say it would be better yet if 0% of the nation's population were engaged in producing food, and food just rolled into the stores by some kind of completely automated thing. So to tie this all back together, I don't think we should be looking for how much we can pay people to do a job, because that's almost missing the point. Doing a job, you as an employee are helping a business to produce an output. You personally are producing corporate histories for other people to read and enjoy. I am producing healthcare software for healthcare organizations to use and hopefully enjoy using. In both cases, I would argue that the world would be better off if those books and that software could be produced with even less labor, even less effort. Here's where I'll make the leap that you may not agree with. The work that people are doing for a business is just part of the cost of producing whatever that business's output is. And we should be eager to see that cost of production go down, 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 down over time, because then the cost of consumption goes down, down, down over time. And ultimately, what we want to get to, what we're on a trajectory for, is many goods consumed and enjoyed at almost zero cost. Because then, what does anybody need to work for? You walk out and pick up the goods that you need. To put it in science fiction, popular entertainment terms, you walk up to your replicator in the wall and you order whatever you want, and it just appears into existence in front of you. So we shouldn't be looking at ways to raise the cost of what it costs a business to produce something. We should be looking at how can we get people the goods that they need to consume and enjoy life. How can we get them those goods most easily and conveniently, rather than how can we get them jobs that pay more? Does that make sense? I know I just rambled for about 5 minutes.
It does. There is a dimension of this that has not been mentioned yet. And I think part of your argument may be a little semantic. I mean, fine, if that is not the purpose of the economy, so be it. But if the purpose of the economy is having a deleterious effect or not meeting the needs of the population as it is performing its purpose, then something should be done. You know, in this mental picture, I feel that you are conjuring, suggesting that we have these, all of these people who need to, who the company has a vested interest in paying it as little as possible in order to keep its prices as low as possible, which then enables the consumers, who are in many cases the employees, to purchase them at low a price as possible. But the motive of the companies is not to keep the price of their goods as low as possible. It is actually to keep their income as high as possible. And if that means lowering the price to a certain level, that's fine. But companies use all manner of tricks and psychology and pressure and sometimes dirty tricks in order to keep that price high. The money is not... this money that's disappearing from workers is not going into just R&R. It's not going into, it's not just being taken off the price of the product. It is, and then the clearest sign of this is the amount of income, or that has been earned by the 1% and so on and so forth, over the past couple of decades, as opposed to the bottom 40 or 50%, who have not received, really a wage increase in that amount of time. The companies are, and to be fair, in part because they have captured the government that you want to listen, is engaged in this act of making war on Adam Smith's perfect market. I just tweeted a link just this past week of Amazon creating a system that will keep you from checking out the prices of other stores' products on their internet. So I guess without rambling further, what would you say to that?
Regarding the specific Amazon example, I saw the link, and I think what they're doing is hilariously, ironically hypocritical. I also don't think it's going to matter much, because there's a lot of stores you can go shopping at. And if you know you walk into an Amazon store and you can't price comparison, how many people are going to walk into an Amazon store under those conditions? I mean, one, how many people are going to walk into an Amazon store, period? The whole genius of Amazon is that it's online. I don't have to walk into a store. I sit in bed with my iPad and look at a product, and 2 days later it's dropped off at my front door and I don't have to go anywhere. So who's going to go to an Amazon store? And who's going to go to an Amazon store if by going there you completely lose all ability to price shop? I don't think anybody is. So I think their patent is, their business idea is offensive. I also think it is, I also think it's harmless, because I don't think it's going to affect things long term. And because they've patented it, it means nobody else can implement that stupid idea. So we've limited the damage to that kind of an idea right off the bat. Boom! Amazon is now the only one who can harass us with that kind of behavior in their store, unless the others are bright enough to come up with a way that doesn't get to do it, that doesn't get them sued into the dirt. So I would agree. Adam Smith would agree. It is not from the benevolence of the baker, the butcher, or the candlestick maker that we get our goods. It is, in fact, from their greed and their avarice as they compete with each other and attempt to undercut each other, stab each other in the back, and walk all over each other's corpses in order to gain one more customer. So I'm not trusting to the kind-heartedness of business to keep anything going. I am, in fact, trusting that they will be greedy enough that they won't be able to work together to keep prices high. You know, the worst idea out there isn't that business would be too greedy, it's that businesses would agree to forgo profit in the interest of working together. And while that occasionally happens for a short period of time, it never happens for a long period of time. They're simply too greedy to work together with each other, and that works to our benefit. There's measurement areas I can get into. You know, if the rich are getting richer, I don't care if the rich are getting richer, as long as the poor are also getting richer. And I know the argument that you mentioned, and that if I failed to acknowledge it, you would re-mention again, is that the income of the bottom 20 percentile has stagnated over the past 30 or 40 years. I've read a fair amount about that over the past couple of years, not doing in-depth research, but just staying up on the conversation about it. And I think there are measurement problems there, one of which is we've had a fair amount of immigration over the last 30 or 40 years. So if we're going to take a certain group of American workers and monitor their income over time as they start out on the bottom, it may very well increase. But if we bring in enough immigrants who come into that very bottom tier and who are at a low wage because they don't speak English well, they don't understand the system well, they don't know how to navigate and maneuver as well, stuff that they'll learn that they'll grow out of. But if we're continually bringing in new immigrants who sit in that bottom tier and you're consistently measuring that bottom tier over time, it may look like it's not moving, But it's not that it's not moving. It's that we're continually bringing new people in on the low end that are hiding the movement that's going on elsewhere. I think there's also measurement issues in terms of household compensation as we increasingly moved from two-earner households to married parent households to increasingly single-earner or just single-parent households. I think if you're measuring household income over time, household income tends to look stagnant, but that's because households are getting smaller rather than the fact that the per capita income is actually stagnant. And I think there's also GDP measurement issues in terms of, Adam, when you watch TV, what size TV are you normally sitting in front of?
This one, the laptop.
Okay.
I'm not trying to be a smarty pants. I just don't know what you want from me.
No, that was not the answer I was expecting, but it's actually a fantastic answer. I'll run with it. You know, our parents, when they watched TV, were likely watching TV on a 13-inch television or a television with a resolution of, well, heck, 480p was considered high definition. It was probably more like 320. What year is your MacBook, if I can ask?
2012, I believe.
Okay, right on the cusp.
Might be a 13.
You might have a Retina Mac. Do you know if you have a Retina MacBook?
No, it's not a Retina. Although,
yeah. More's the pity. You're still watching TV on a monitor, on a screen, with a substantially higher resolution than anything our parents ever watched TV on, especially when they were growing up. You're watching TV on a device that is not actually pulling signals over the air, unless you have a TV tuner for your Mac, which I doubt, but correct me now if I'm wrong. You are watching television content that has been pre-recorded and time-shifted, made available for you to watch at your convenience, at your leisure, in as much or as little of a chunk as you want. Our parents watched TV when it was on, if it was on, and only for as long as it was on. And so your consumption of entertainment is, I won't say immeasurably, I'm sure someone could put a measurement on this, but your consumption of entertainment is far better. My consumption of entertainment is far better at our age than it was for our parents at their ages. Now, most of that improvement is not picked up in official government measurements of income and well-being. It looks like things are stagnant when in fact things have gotten much, much, much better. Your ability, my ability, almost anyone's ability to be entertained is so, so much better than it was 30 or 40 years ago. That to say that incomes are stagnant and nobody's life has gotten better over the last 30 years is, I think, extremely misleading. Are there certain people for whom that's true? Yes, undeniably. But I think it's a small, far smaller percentage than it looks like. And so when we're talking about our businesses and the economy ripping everybody off, and there's a group, a significant group that has just been left in stagnation, I would say no. Because I think quality of life, I think incomes have gone up. And I think quality of life, regardless of income, has gotten much better over the last 40 years. And I would again bring that back to the question is not how can we get somebody a job that pays $25, $30, $40 an hour. The problem is how can we get everybody a decent standard of living? And now I've been rambling, so I'll let you respond.
Well, if you haven't, take your point that standards have improved, but I think the idea that there is not a greater level of income equality inequality today than 50 years ago is just madness. I realize that doesn't. And okay, so you've said that you don't really care about that, but when 5% of households, and yes, I did just look this up, are currently experiencing very low food security. you know, that matters.
Yep.
Again, as Martin Luther King said, justice delayed is justice denied. Or as Keane said, in the long run, we are all dead. I'm pleased to hear that we're on track and still progressing. But in a time of widening income inequality, this is an unacceptable situation to me. And if there are alternatives to a minimum wage, I'm okay with that. We can discuss them. But these massive companies can afford this. Also, I'd like to mention one more thing, which is that we talk about such things as Amazon was... I posted the Amazon thing because it was amusing as much as it was infuriating. The idea that these massive companies just can't resist competing is... I don't think that's a law at all. From the robber barons of old to the modern cable companies, there are mega companies have proven very willing to cooperate, which is why Roosevelt had to do some trust busting back in the 1910s. These companies are capable of doing a massive amount of damage. We talk about this silly thing where Amazon did it, but for example, the whole train car system of San Francisco was ripped up so that people had to buy cars. these companies have an awful lot of power, and they tend to toward consolidation.
But companies exercise their power through the political system. I mean, my argument would be is if you're afraid of companies exercising power, why are we creating a massive government for them to exercise power through? Because a company does not have force on its own except where it's borrowing government force.
That's not true, though. Come on. Have you done nothing more than Red Grapes of Wrath? I mean, if you're a miner working in, a land owned by the mining company and going to the store at the company store, you know, I mean, you are in these people's hands. A company can, I mean, maybe it's just that I've been in Korea, although, but, you know, there's three companies that run most of that country.
and I would argue that they exercise a great deal of power through the political system. We can stick a fork in this because I don't want to get sidetracked. I've actually read some very interesting things about company stores. They are portrayed in popular culture as being unmitigated evils. I've actually read some very interesting defenses of the company store in ways in which they made sense for both the company and for the worker, which I think is an interesting discussion I would like to table until I've had time to actually re-find those references and be able to talk about them concretely rather than just in a vague half-remembered sense. Going back to the robber barons, Standard Oil is one of the large companies that was broken up by Teddy Roosevelt. And Standard Oil did have a very dominant market position. But Standard Oil had a very dominant market position because it offered oil at a far lower price than any of its competitors could offer. It grew not by forcibly taking over the market, but by offering a high-quality product at a lower price than anyone else could. And companies were continually either going under or being bought out by Standard Oil because they couldn't compete with the price and with the service that whichever oil baron was offering. And Teddy Roosevelt broke them up at the strong request and begging of their competitors who were unable to compete in the marketplace. And the story that I've heard that has resonated and stuck with me is that the owner of the company would walk through the factory paying attention to the smallest of details, looking for places where he could cut costs to undercut his competitors on price. And one of the areas he found was looking at barrels and counting the number of rivets that were put into the barrels to physically make them, to transport the oil, and asking the workmen, why are we putting 14 rivets in? Could we get by with 13? Well, I don't know. Test it and find out. Hey, we can get by with 13. Guess what? I just shaved 2 cents off of the cost of a barrel of oil. I can undercut my competitors and sell that oil cheaper. And so, yes, it was a giant company, but it was not a giant company because it was ripping people off. It was a giant company because it was selling a product at a better price than anybody else was. So I, you know, that's kind of a side part. I don't want to get into a massive debate about robber barons and re-arguing all of American history, but I didn't want to let it go unchallenged either. I don't agree with the contention that big business left unchecked exploits anybody and everybody everywhere, because I do strongly believe that business, unprotected by government, will constantly seek to undercut other businessmen in pursuit of a profit, and that that redounds to the benefit of everyone in the economy. And if all that happens is that another oil company is hurt, I'm fine with that. As long as the consumer is getting either cheaper oil or higher quality oil at the same price, which is really just another way of saying cheaper oil. As far as income inequality goes, I think you and I might disagree here. I don't think inequality is a problem. I don't think income inequality is a problem. I'm far more interested in consumption equality or consumption inequality. And going back to this question of can people consume what they want, when they want, how they want, as much as they want, because that's what really matters. I don't care if my income is $100,000 or $10,000. What I care about is, can I sit down in front of a 50-inch television, fire up a PlayStation, and play the latest game that just came out? And if I can do all that on $10,000 a year, hallelujah. If I have to have $100,000 a year, then so be it. I'll find a way to get that much money. But really what I'm interested in is, what can I consume? And I think at root, that's what you're interested in as well, is can people, and consume, I know every time, I'm thinking every time I say this, consume has a negative connotation in our culture. It's looked down upon to be enjoying life and to just be taking stuff and consuming. But I honestly think that is the crux of the matter, is do you have the freedom to, free from want, sit down, enjoy a healthy, delicious, fun dinner with a family that's healthy, in a house that's strong, in a safe neighborhood, wearing comfortable, well-fitting, attractive clothes? If you can do all of that, I don't care what your income level is, and I am not quite sure that you do either, although perhaps you would say differently, but I don't think it matters what your income level is. It matters how much you can enjoy life.
I regard that to some degree as semantic. I mean, no, I think you're right about that. My concern and my rage, if you will, at income inequality has to do with what people are not capable of consuming right now. It is obscene that a handful of people possess as much wealth as they do in the United States when there is still food insecurity. I wrote this down in my notes, but there is a court term, unconscionable. You may have heard it in other circumstances, but the one that comes to my mind as a writer is Hollywood accounting, which is to say that the Hollywood accountants came up with this fantastic legal system whereby a movie could make $1 billion and yet not make a profit. And then they could tell the writer, sorry, I know we promised you a little percentage, but we just didn't make anything. And this legal term, this idea that at a certain point an outcome is unconscionable, that you can create as brilliant a logical construct as you want, but there are some outcomes which are completely unacceptable. Which are clearly at some point an abuse of logic. And incidentally, I'd like to add that moving between ideological systems as I have over my life, there comes a point at which you realize just how ephemeral such systems are, how much ironclad sense they make until you are out of them. And, you know, if Jesus was real and he said everything he did, and he was, or even if he was God, I suspect this is what lies at the root of his hatred of legalism, that ultimately it's so much of it is excuses. But if we have hungry people in America because they're being paid $6 an hour, then income inequality matters. And they would be able to consume a dignified amount of product, if we wish to put it into those terms, if they were making a living wage or a universal basic income.
Yeah, that's that universal basic income I want to focus on, because I think a living wage conflicts with the idea to drive conflicts with the ability to drive the cost of consumption to zero. And ultimately what I'm interested in is driving the cost of consumption to zero. Ideally, everyone would be unemployed in the classical sense. No one would need to work and able to survive and enjoy life. Now, that doesn't mean you wouldn't be working. I know you well enough from our conversations over the past couple of months to say, in an ideal world, you would be writing your novel, you would be producing comics, you might even be producing screenplays. You would be doing that which you enjoy because your material needs are taken care of. You'd be spending far more time on your creative endeavors if you didn't have to earn an income in order to do your part of taking care of Adam and Anna Inc. And so it's ultimately not that no one would have anything to do, but that everyone would be unemployed in the classical sense of not needing to earn a salary, not needing to earn a wage in order to survive. And that's what I'm interested in, is let's get that cost of consumption to zero. Now, we live in an economy right now where the cost of consumption is not zero. Businesses do require employees in order to produce whatever it is they're producing. And those employees do need to have an income of some sort in order to purchase what they need to get through life. The problem I see with a minimum wage is that the concerns about job loss are not academic. It's more than job loss. What concerns me is the people who never get jobs in the first place. The people whose skills are low enough that they are unemployable at $7 an hour or $9 an hour or $13 or $15 an hour. Because most of the employment in the U.S. is done by small businesses, not by large businesses. Done by businesses who have a very razor-thin profit margin, 2, 3, 4%. Businesses to where if the cost of labor goes up, because I understand what you're saying about human beings being more than just labor, but from the production side, employing a human being is a necessary, is a necessary evil towards producing whatever it is that you're producing. And you are producing a good that you can only sell for so much money. And that amount of money that comes in for the good has to cover all of the expenses of producing the good. And one of those expenses is paying your employees a salary. And the more that salary goes up, you either have to raise prices to compensate or you have to cut quality in other areas. There generally is not enough margin to go around to say, oh, we'll just take it out of the profit margin. There often isn't that profit margin to take it out of. And so what you may say is, I no longer have time for on-the-job training. At $7 an hour, I have enough extra time. I can spread the work around more. I can train people. I can bring them in untrained and I can show them the ropes. I can teach them what it means to show up on time, take a limited number of breaks, and stay 15 minutes late to close up, I can teach them how to do that basic skill of just how to show up and work a job. Whereas at $9, $13, or $15 an hour, I need maximum efficiency in order to cover my costs, and therefore I don't have time for on-the-job training anymore, so the only people I'm hiring are the people that are already experienced. And then if you're an employee, or if you're a wannabe employee who doesn't have the necessary skills, sorry, you're out of luck. You can't get a job. And this is not academic. You know, San Francisco raised the minimum wage, and suddenly as it starts to kick in and take effect, we've got lower-end restaurants in San Francisco shutting down. This was a research paper that came out not that long ago that the researchers found after the minimum wage increase took effect, there was a direct correlation between a restaurant's Yelp star review ratings and whether or not that restaurant was still open after the minimum wage increase took effect. And the lower your Yelp star rating was, generally the cheaper your restaurant was, the more likely you were to go out of business. That the restaurants that charge $50 a plate, $150 a couple for dinner, they can afford to pay out that $13 an hour minimum wage. The restaurants that are charging $10 for a meal, $5 for a meal, can't afford it, and so they're just closing down, and everybody that used to work for them is now out of a job. And worse, those restaurants are no longer there to hire inexperienced people and teach them how to be good employees. Seattle, there was a story that report research that just came out today. It was on 538 and everywhere else. About a research study that was done in Seattle that's finding as Seattle's minimum wage is jumping from, I believe, 9 to 11, that they're also seeing increased job loss, or maybe it's 11 to 13. I think it's 11 to 13. I think the minimum wage had been 9. Had it gone up to 11, there hadn't been much effect. It had gone from 11 to 13, and suddenly there is much effect. That again, a higher minimum wage is costing people jobs, and I think worse than costing people jobs, it's preventing people from getting jobs in the first place. So I want people to have that minimum income, but I think doing it by forcing a business to pay a higher wage is the wrong way to do it.
I'm aware of I'm aware of both San Francisco and Seattle. There was an interesting set of blog posts by a San Francisco comic book store owner. The Seattle paper is, I recall being contested somewhat, but I did read about it to the National Review. What is there to say? I'm aware very much of the drawback. Again, it is a issue of values, but, and if there's an alternative way of, making, that floor, then I'm interested in discussing it. But other countries have small businesses and have imposed a livable wage. I think I'd be all for exploring this more, but I don't think that discussion gets had outside of essentially the Democratic Party. Republicans are very much in the hands of large corporations that basically don't care. Libertarians don't have real power any more than the Green Party.
Now, I'm going to step in and say, I think you're being unfair to certain Republicans. And I think it matters in this case very much who we're referring to when we refer to Republicans, because there has been very much a debate on the right over the past 8-10 years over how to better take care of the working class. And not in the take them out back and shoot them sense, but in the how to have an economic policy that is good for the people at the bottom as much as it is for the people at the top. Now, you can argue none of that's shown up in actual bills and legislations in this Congress, and I would agree, and that goes back to the tweet I posted earlier today. This Republican majority has been extremely disappointing
In terms of what leadership has actually been willing to bring up and to talk about. But in terms of Republican think tanks and the more policy-oriented Republicans in the party, there has very much been a discussion. One of, in fact, the big things that's been done over the past several decades is what Milton Friedman first proposed as a negative income tax. This idea that there is an income tax where the government takes money from you if your income is above a certain level, and that if your income is below a certain level, your income tax is negative. The government gives money back to you. And I thought this was a pretty clever idea when I first read it in Free to Choose.
Does this not exist?
This exists. This is right, the earned income tax credit, which, to be fair, Republicans proposed and passed, I believe, during the Clinton administration, may have been earlier, either during Bush 1 or Reagan. I'm a bit fuzzy on that, but there is the earned income tax credit, which is basically a negative income tax. We give you money if your income is too low. And there have been various proposals put forth to increase the EITC, which Democrats generally oppose rather than support, because they'd rather push for higher minimum wage. And the EITC is not perfect. I would say the biggest downside is you only get it once a year, and it's a lump sum payout. I think if you're really going to be helping somebody, you need something that shows up in paycheck to paycheck. Now, if you're super savvy and you can manipulate all of the deductions and everything else when you're filling out your W-2 form, or your W-4, yeah, W-4, you can get that money showing up ahead of time. Some of it, not all of it. So I don't think the EITC is perfect, but I don't want to let you get away with saying that the Republicans are basically the party that wants to let people die in the streets because they obey corporate overlords. That is an unfair characterization.
Yeah, the EITC, very much, that's the whole issue of healthcare subsidies versus tax credits. I mean, it's very much a case of a lot of people not being able to wait a year in order to get that money. But, you know, if the Republican Party were Sodom or Gomorrah right now, then no, I don't think there are a whole ton of righteous involved at the higher levels. I mean, now, as far as the Conservative Party, I'm still inside of that, and, you know, reading the columnists and so forth, and I understand that there is an ideology that suggests that everything's going to get better. I just think it flies in the face of reality. Are we talking about their good intentions? Fine, but I'm past awarding credit for that.
I disagree that it's even about intentions, though. I mean, Ramesh Ponnaroo is one of the ones that writes fairly frequently for National Review, and he's been a huge part of this conversation about reform conservatism and what are the policies that we can enact in order to better shore up the safety net for America's poor. This has very much been a discussion. Now, has it gotten on the agenda of this Congress? No. But again, I'm going to disagree if you say that the discussion hasn't been there and that it's just a vague generalized hope that everything gets better over time, because that's not what it's been. It's been a discussion about specific policies, whether it's through tax credits, whether it's through spending, whether it's through changing rules. There has been a discussion about how can we change things to make things better for the poor. It has been a policy-oriented discussion.
Haven't read it, to be fair. Oh, sorry, yeah. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, I'll grant it isn't written about in the New York Times. It isn't written about in the Washington Post. They seem to have an interest in ignoring those discussions. But as someone who has been on the right side of the blogosphere for a really long time, whether that's conservative or whether that's libertarian, it has been a very active discussion.
This is something that I mean, we're not going to have time to discuss now, mirrors the discussion of violent rhetoric. The American parties are very large, those that claim to be a part of them. You can find exceptions to rules everywhere. But ultimately, there's a difference between discussions that people are having in some wing of a party and what the leaders are doing and saying. And that, you know, you mentioned this Congress is disappointing, but this Congress is the Republican Party at present. And
I'll make it more specific then. Paul Ryan is pissing me the heck off because he had been one of the leaders of reform conservatism, putting forth good ideas for reforms, for changing things. And they were ideas that, yes, honestly, were infuriating the left, but that did not necessarily make them bad ideas. I was optimistic when I saw Paul Ryan gaining power within the Republican Party. When Mitt Ryan selected him as running mate, I thought that was a good thing. When he was in discussion to be the leader of the Ways and Means Committee, which writes tax law, I thought that was a good thing. When he was going to be elevated to the speakership, I thought that was a good thing. Paul Ryan, frankly, the rhetoric of what he proposed years ago versus what he's actually pursuing as speaker has been a fairly wide and disappointing gap. I could name other leaders of the Republican Party that I'm disappointed in, but Ryan was one I had honestly hoped for better from him. And so when I say there was conversations, there was conversations. He was a part of it. I have no idea what's going through his head now as Speaker of the House. But he doesn't seem to be doing anything with any of the ideas that he had formerly espoused. But that doesn't mean that there weren't other people engaged in those conversations who weren't sincere and who didn't have legitimate designs on party leadership. So I don't want to tar, maybe I'm sensitive to this because I see it happening online a lot, this tarring of the entire party with a broad brush. And I don't think that's fair. And I think there's ways I could slander the Democrat Party based on the behavior of substantial numbers of its members that also wouldn't be fair to the party as a whole. And I would say if I'm committed to anything as a hopeless libertarian, it's the idea that both parties are filled with jerks, idiots, nincompoops, and evil, power-hungry politicians. And both parties are filled with idealists who want to make the world a better place. And it drives me nuts when I see someone who is a partisan of one party or the other slandering the opposite party as being the source of all evil in the world.
Well, I don't think that's what I'm doing. But I think as someone who has spent not as much time as you anymore, because our paths diverged fairly recently, but as someone who has who until recently spent just as much time as you damning both the houses, that I am not blind to the drawbacks. And in fact, I spent most of the Obama years, pointing my withering Twitter fire at his administration. Again, what it comes down to, I think, and, you know, I still haven't joined the Democratic Party. I flirted with the idea, but the only thing that really threw me behind into the recent partisan wars was the realization that the Republican Party had gone mad and that there was a slight chance that a person who seemed like a decently good man, Bernie Sanders, could have been president. But for all that these bodies that are the parties are filled with these people who are good and evil and torn by these conflicting motivations and so on and so forth, which as someone who is surrounded by Republican friends and family, I understand. In the end, someone is currently leading this party. There are people in the driver's seat, and you have to look at who's in the driver's seat and then decide whether you're going to get in the car or get out of the car or not. And to your credit and the credit of several other friends I have, when the Republican Party did choose its driver in 2016, you had the principle to get out of the car. It is my belief, and on my principle, I got in the car of the Democratic Party because when you're in a war, you know, in the very, very metaphorical term of the war, when something is happening, and I believe that this is a very important time in our country, you get on the good side and you don't worry over much about the flaws, so that the main point, as long as the main points are in order. And Obama, for example, and Clinton are capitalist, and they are, you know, very much and have a lot of similarities and all the rest. Let me rephrase that. Obama and Clinton are both clearly corrupt politicians. But what Obama tried to do in his first 2 years of office was get people health care and lessen the number of black people who are being shot by cops, and showed greater reticence in using force, even though he used drones in extra legal ways that horrified me, and so on and so forth. Clinton, I feel, in many ways would have done the same. I believe that at present, and that this could easily change, but that there is a right side in the current ongoing debate, and that it is very much the blue camp. The people who are for, you know, or who are anti-discriminating, as opposed to the people who are led by the person who didn't believe that Obama was born here. The people who believe in a floor, of a safety net, as opposed to the people who clearly do not, whatever else they used to espouse, or, you know, or whatever they secretly believe in their heads. The people who believe that some measure of military reticence to use the military is at least a good talking point, versus the Republican Party, which is, as far as I can tell, is you know, just bangs the war drum whenever it sees anyone that it considers a threat.
Well, I think there. Okay. I'll stop you there, because again, I think you have become more partisan than you realize, perhaps. If we're going to talk about the party of war, Hillary Clinton was the candidate who was far more willing to use military force in the last presidential election. Donald Trump, for all that I don't think he's going to stick to it, and for all of his myriad other flaws, at times seemed to be almost in the Rand Paul wing of the party in saying that military force should not be used, that America should not be going outside of its borders, that the rest of the world should fend for itself, and the United States should spend money at home rather than spending money abroad. Do I think he's going to stick to it? No. Do I think he's going to let himself get insulted and decide to use the military in retaliation? Yes. But as much as to the extent that the man has any political philosophy at all, his political philosophy was at least that the military should not be being sent abroad, and that the money should not be being spent on foreign adventurism. It should be spent at home building a big, beautiful wall, which you can quibble with the big building a big, beautiful wall part. But it at least, I think, was undeniable that he was arguing that we should not be spending the money on fighting tons of foreign wars. So in terms of, is there a winner between the two sides? I don't trust either one of them, but I think in terms of espoused rhetoric, it was Hillary Clinton that was far more interventionist than Donald Trump was.
I feel like we could get into a whole conversation about this. Simply put, I would say that Donald Trump's positions on issues are almost not worth discussing.
almost indecipherable. I will give you that. But I think it is undeniable that Hillary Clinton was a very, very hawkish candidate, far more than Obama was.
I would agree with that, as opposed to, yes, much more so, at least than Obama. But I would also suggest that, you know, most of the situations that we were discussing, well, no, okay, this would jump into things. You may deduct 1 point if you like from my overall assessment. I remain fairly convinced. It was Trump that horrified me into not voting for, that convinced me that the Republicans had lost it and that I needed to vote for Clinton. And then it has since been the Republican Party that has convinced me that it is that I need to go on to continue supporting the Democrats.
Yeah, as a libertarian, I am honor bound to insist that there is no reason to support a corrupt two-party system, that we should instead be supporting a corrupt four-party system, and that anybody who is voting for one of the two biggest, most corruptest parties is part of the problem, not part of the solution, and that if you're honor-bound to jump out of the car when it is run off of the rails, you should be jumping out of the Democratic car as much as you should be jumping out of the Republican car, and should be joining us out here on the political fringes of greater morality. So I'll just leave that there.
You tend to, I think this is a general thing with you, Joe, but I mean, so far as I can tell, you tend to assess morality in terms of how little you, how few things you have broken, as opposed to how much good you do.
I think this
is a general question of your morality. Like, I mean, you know, going back to your whole, you know, I'm not comfortable with anyone but God being on the throne, and so I'm not going to get involved in any of this stuff that the Bible doesn't have a problem with.
I know what you're saying, and I think what you're arguing is, if I can choose the slightly less corrupt party to the party that is slightly better at talking the language of political benevolence, then I'm doing some good.
No, I am. That would have been what I would have perhaps made fun of other people for saying back when I was a libertarian. What I am saying now is that I think I am doing a lot of good by supporting the much better party against a group of people that have a party that has moved way too far to whatever end of whatever spectrum you want to use, and is a serious threat.
But you say you're doing good by supporting a higher minimum wage. So what do you say to all of the workers in Seattle and San Francisco who are now unemployed because of that higher minimum wage? You haven't done good there. You've made their lives worse off. They were better off earning $11 an hour than they are earning $0 an hour sitting home unemployed. So what do you say to them?
Very specific example of the larger subject we're talking about. Again, I'm not going to argue for 100% hit rate, but I would argue that establishing the floor forces companies in the long run to part with part of their enormous profits in order to hire the people.
Which companies with enormous profits?
I mention
that because it's the second or third time you've brought it up. But which companies paying minimum wage with enormous profits?
Apple.
Not paying minimum wage.
Not at the stores?
Nope. Absolutely not. Those people are highly paid.
What is your average Apple salesman making? Lie to me.
Is
it $15 an hour?
In north of that, I would say.
Where?
Those people are good. Apple has the highest income per square foot of any retail organization, and their employees are a key part of making that the highest income per square foot. Their employees. No, I don't have the dollar figures. I could try Googling them. I'm not going to right now.
All right,
but their employees make significantly above.
McDonald's revenue, and I am just going to Google real quick. 2016, $24.62 billion in U.S.
profit margin. What is their profit margin?
This is all getting really involved.
McDonald's as a whole, quarterly profit margin 21.4%. Healthy, very healthy. Net profit margin? Yeah, this is something I'd want to come back to after doing a smidge of research, because I think there's a difference between profit margin and raw profit. Profit margin being the extent to which you can absorb cost increases. And I would argue that the vast majority of McDonald's locations are local franchises owned by franchisees and are small businesses rather than part of the McDonald's conglomerate, and that a franchise's profit margins are far, far lower than the parent company's profit margins are.
If you like, but back to my accusations of tribalism, I am not convinced that Democrats have a lock on the proper policy for going forward. But I do believe that we would be in a much worse off country if Republicans continued to maintain power. I don't see how that's even... I mean, obviously it's completely arguable because enough people have gone with it, but there seems to be at present to be one moderate party.
Yeah, I'm gonna sidestep that discussion because honestly, I don't find it to be that interesting. I know other people do. I don't. So I think I would circle back to minimum wage and say, yes, it's easy to say that raising the minimum wage, I'm making the world better. I'm making people better off. And I would argue, no, you're not. There are specific people that you're making better off. Those who are lucky enough to keep their jobs at a higher wage, they are better off. And there are another group of people that are worse off who now have no job. And it seems overly simplistic to say, I support a higher minimum wage. I'm making the world a better place. I think that's very arguable indeed.
You're going back to minimum wage. I was going all the way back to tribalism. Anyway, all right.
Tribalism. You know, I want to save that. I want to save that discussion tied into political extremism. I think, because I do think the two are a little bit related. And so, minimum wage. I would say we share the same goal, which is to have people better off, less worried about the basic necessities of life. And I think a minimum wage is a bad way to do that. I think there are better ways to do that, and we should be having the conversation about what is the best way to ensure that people have what they need to make a different, decent life, but without a policy that is inherently problematic as putting workers out of a job so that we can give other workers a pay raise. And I feel like we've each stated our positions three or four times. I feel like this is the third or fourth time I've stated that position, so I don't want to keep flogging a dead horse.
Sure.
And perhaps it's time to say that we have reached the bottom of the minimum wage. And should turn to another topic. But again, I think we've been flogging our listeners for another hour and a half at this point, so we should probably put it down and pick up the conversation again next time.
They're hardy, our listeners. I'm sure they could took it.
They take it well, week after week. But it's been a good conversation. I think maybe it sounded a bit heated at times, but frankly, I don't know if this is coming across to the listeners or not, but I've been enjoying myself immensely. It's not often I get the chance to tell other people why they're wrong and have them tell me why I'm wrong. So I've been having a marvelous time.
Me too, Joe. Me too. I'm glad we're getting reacquainted.
I'm glad we're getting reacquainted as well. Thanks, Adam.
Bye-bye.
If you like the show, help new listeners find it by listening to Reacquainted and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to Reacquainted, and give it a rating. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following at FromVoxDuo on Twitter. That's at FromVoxDuo. Adam is on Twitter. His handle is at Adam Volle. That's Adam Volle. Joe blogs at minorthoughts.com, and he's on Twitter as well, at jmartindf.